half us got, well half us don't. Half attend the university, well half us won't. Half of us be broke, well half got dough. Half of us don't know what it means to reap what you sow. Half of us pull guns, half of us wear vests. Half my crew turn this game into one big mess. Half of us are living large, well half us stress. Half us are using food stamps, half cash checks. And it could have been avoided, but half us left. Half of us are thinking right now what they're going to regret. Most of y'all dummies have a penny and plenty. Half with it, probably get a chicken, half in it. Your father was a nut, he was probably half committed. Half of us will go to jail, half will get acquitted. Half of us are smart, half ain't got no brains. Half of these chickens are letting raw dogs run trains. Cut the world in half, it's a lot of good and bad. A lot of love and happiness, a lot is really sad. A lot of us are sanity, a lot of us are mad. Reaching out for pleasure when there's nothing left to grab. A lot of us are living in the shadows of our past. Running from a present that we never wish to have. A lot of us are followers to worship every fad. Chasing after money, but we never got the math. Half a scheme, plot to leave the ghetto with dreams. So we laid the fuck out, coming out with half a team. Half a family, half of our relationship is shady. Half of us are going half on a baby. Half of us are real thoroughbreds, half of us are squealers. Half of us are broke ass, wanna be drug dealers. Half of us are scared straight, or half make noise. Half of us don't even smoke, cause we're too paranoid. Half of us wanna be rappers, half play ball. Half of us won't even make it out the ghetto at all. Doubt fear, this song's gonna get me the cake. Half of y'all are give me love, half of y'all are give me hate. The world in half, it's a lot of good and bad. A lot of love and happiness, a lot is really sad. A lot of us are sanity, a lot of us are mad. Reaching out for pleasure when there's nothing left to grab. A lot of us are living in the shadows of our past. Running from a present that we never wish to have. A lot of us are followers to worship every fad. Chasing after money, but we never got the math. Half us win, while half us lose. Half a murder by police on the front page news. Half of us don't march, while half protest. Half of us are just getting by and don't want to stress. Half of us got faith, half never believe. Half are behind steel bars and trying to achieve. While half a disease in a third world village. Feeling helpless for bigger nations to come in this village. And half a gorillas in a forest at large. Brainwashing some little kid to pick up an arm. While half is alarmed, half a living like this. So they donate money to half needing it missed. And half of us rich will be winners in lotto. Soon we wake up laying in piss, holding the bottle. Half a push in the throttle until the car's out of gas. Half a wondering why this whole song is in half.
They are, we are.
Cut the world in half, it's a lot of good and bad. A lot of love and happiness, a lot is really sad. A lot of us are sanity, a lot of us are mad. Reaching out for pleasure when there's nothing left to grab. A lot of us are living in the shadows of our past. Running from a present that we never wish to have. A lot of us are followers to worship every fad. Chasing after money, but we never got the math.
Hello, everybody, and good evening. Thank you for tuning in and listening to New Groove and Rhythms tonight. I just have gotten off work, and I haven't done a radio show in a little while, so I'm kind of tired, but I need to do one. So here I am. Hello, hello. That was Duffier with the song Half of Us. And I read this article today on GQ.com. And I thought it was fascinating. And I usually don't do this, but I wanted to read it because I think it's really cool. A little, you know, not sad, well, kind of sad, but like not like sad gonna make you cry, but it's like almost sad and inspiring at the same time. I just think it's really interesting. So it's called The Strange and Curious Tale of the Last True Hermit, which I can't imagine, like, this is the last hermit. So that's a little strange that they put that. But I mean, like, I'm sure there's other ones because this guy that the story is about lived in the woods for something like 25 or 30 years. And if he went that long without being noticed, I'm sure there are others out there doing the same thing, especially in more remote locations. you know, I mean, imagine the mountains or something. There's so much space out there. There's no way you could possibly know, like, if there aren't any more. But it's the strange and curious tale of the last true hermit. I found it on GQ.com today, and it's by Michael Finkel, published on August 4th, 2014, which is interesting that I'm just now seeing it today, since it was, or at least it was written in 2014. Actually, I'm not sure the published date. Let me see if I still have it up. But, I mean, it was, like, on the news thing today when I opened my computer. Yeah, I don't know the published date, but that was at least when it was written, if not published. And I actually copy-pasted it off of their website because it was kind of lagging when I tried to scroll through the page because of the pictures and ads and stuff. But, yeah, check it out. This is really cool. For nearly 30 years, a phantom haunted the woods of central Maine. Unseen and unknown, he lived in secret, creeping into homes in the dead of night and surviving on what he could steal. To the spooked locals, he became a legend, or maybe a myth. They wondered how he could possibly be real, until one day last year, the hermit came out of the forest. The hermit set out at midnight, carrying his backpack and his bag of break-in tools, and threaded through, I'm guessing that it says threaded, maybe it means threaded, through the forest, rock to root to rock, every step memorized, not a boot print left behind. It was cold and nearly moonless, a fine night for a raid, so he hiked about an hour to the Pine Tree Summer Camp, a few dozen cabins spread along the shoreline of North Pond in central Maine. With an expert twist of a screwdriver, he popped open a door of the dining hall and slipped inside, scanning the pantry shelves with his penlight. Candy, always good, 10 rolls of Smarties stuffed in a pocket. Then in his backpack, a bag of marshmallows, 2 tubs of ground coffee, some Humpty Dumpty potato chips, burgers and bacon were in the locked freezer. On a previous raid at the pine tree, he'd stolen a key to the walk-in, and now he used it to open the stainless steel door. The key was attached to a plastic four-leaf clover keychain with one of the leaves partially broken off, a 3.5-leaf clover. He could have used a little more luck. Newly installed in the pine tree kitchen, hidden behind the ice machine, was a military-grade motion detector. The device remained silent in the kitchen, but sounded an alarm in the home of Sergeant Terry Hughes, a game warden who had become obsessed with catching the thief. Hughes lived a mile away. He raced to the camp in his pickup truck and sprinted to the rear of the dining hall. He peeked in a window, and there he was, probably. The person stealing food appeared entirely too clean, his face freshly shaved. He wore eyeglasses and a wool ski hat. Was this really the North Pond Hermit? A man who had tormented the surrounding community for years, decades, yet the police still hadn't learned his name? Hughes used his cell phone quietly and asked the Maine State Police to alert a trooper, Diane Perkins Vance, who had also been hunting the hermit. Before Perkins Vance could get there, the burglar, his backpack full, started towards the exit. If the man stepped into the forest, Hughes understood he might never be found again. The burglar eased out of the dining hall, and Hughes used his left hand to blind the man with his flashlight. With his right, he aimed his .357 square on his nose. "Get on the ground," he bellowed. Well, interesting so far, right? All right. The thief complied, no resistance, and lay face down, candy spilling out of his pockets. It was 1:30 in the morning on April 4th, 2013. Perkins Vance soon arrived, and the burglar was placed handcuffed in a plastic chair. The officers asked his name. He refused to answer. His skin was strangely pale. His glasses, with chunky plastic frames, were extremely outdated. But he wore a nice Columbia jacket, new Lands' End blue jeans, and sturdy boots. The officers searched him, and no identification was located.
Hughes left the suspect alone with Perkins Vance. She removed his handcuffs and gave him a bottle of water. And he started to speak, a little. When Perkins Vance asked why he didn't want to answer any questions, he said he was ashamed. He spoke haltingly, uncertainly. The connection between his mind and mouth seemed to have atrophied from disuse. But over the next couple of hours, he gradually opened up. His name, he revealed, was Christopher Thomas Knight, born on December 7, 1965. He said he had no address, no vehicle, did not file a tax return, and did not receive mail. He said he lived in the woods. For how long, wondered Perkins Vance. Knight thought for a bit, then asked when the Chernobyl nuclear plant disaster occurred. He had long ago lost the habit of marking time in months or years. This was just news, a news event that happened. He happened to remember. The nuclear meltdown took place in 1986, the same year, Knight said, he went to live in the woods. He was 20 years old at the time, not long out of high school. He was now 47, a middle-aged man. Knight stated that over all those years, he slept only in a tent. He never lit a fire for fear that smoke would give his camp away. He moved strictly at night. He said he didn't know if his parents were alive or dead. He'd not made one phone call or driven in a car or spent any money. He had never in his life sent an email or even seen the internet. He confessed that he committed approximately 40 robberies a year while in the woods, a total of more than 1,000 break-ins, but never when anyone was home. He said he stole food and kitchenware and propane tanks and reading material and a few other items. Knight admitted that everything he possessed in the world he'd stolen, including the clothes he was wearing, right down to his underwear. The only exception was his eyeglasses. Perkins Vance called dispatch and learned that Knight had no criminal record. He said he grew up in a nearby community, and his senior picture was soon located in the 1984 Lawrence High School yearbook. He was wearing the same eyeglasses. For close to 3 decades, Knight said he had not seen a doctor or taken any medicine. He mentioned that he had never once been sick. You have to have contact with other humans, he claimed, in order to get sick. When said Perkins Vance was the last time he'd had contact with another person. Sometime in the 1990s, answered Knight. He passed a hiker while walking in the woods. What did you say? Asked Perkins Vance. I said hi, Knight replied. Other than that single syllable. What? Oh, no. I'm going to have to... it told me I set the wrong time for the show. Sorry. And I will keep on, and you're just going to, I guess, have to listen to it in the podcast. But I'm going to continue reading. Okay. I said hi, Knight replied. Other than that single syllable, he insisted he had not spoken with or touched another human being until this night for 27 years. Christopher Knight was arrested, charged with burglary and theft, and transported to the Kennebec County Jail in Augusta, the state capital. For the first time in nearly 10,000 days, he slept indoors. News of the capture stunned the citizens of North Pond. For decades, they'd felt haunted by something. It was hard to say what. At first, in the late 1980s, there were strange occurrences. Flashlights were missing, their batteries, steaks disappeared from the fridge. New propane tanks on the grill had been replaced by old ones. My grandkids thought I was losing my mind, said David Prulix, whose vacation cabin was broken into at least 50 times. The people began noticing other things, wood shavings near window locks, scratches on door frames. Was it a neighbor? A gang of teenagers? The robberies continued. Boat batteries, frying pans, winter jackets. Fear took hold. We always felt like he was watching us, one resident said. The police were called repeatedly, but they were unable to help. Locks were changed, alarm systems installed. Nothing seemed to stop him, or her, or them. No one knew. A few desperate residents even left notes on their doors. Please don't break in. Tell me what you need, and I'll leave it out for you. There was never a reply. incidents mounted, and the phantom morphed into a legend. Eventually, he was given a name, the North Pond Hermit. At a homeowners meeting in 2002, the 100 people present were asked who had suffered break-ins. 75 raised their hands. Campfire hermit stories were swapped. One kid recalled that when he was 10 years old, all his Halloween candy was stolen. That kid is now 34. Still, the robberies persisted. The crimes, after so long, felt almost supernatural. The legend of the hermit lived on for years and years, said Pete Cogswell, whose jeans and belt were worn by the hermit when he was caught. Did I believe it? No. Who really could? Night's arrest, rather than eliminating disbelief, only enhanced it. The truth was stranger than the myth. One man had actually lived in the woods of Maine for 27 years in an unheated nylon tent. Winters in Maine are long and intensely cold. A wet, windy cold, the worst kind of cold. A week of winter camping is an impressive achievement. An entire season is practically unheard of. Though hermits have been documented for thousands of years, Knight's feat appears to exist in a category of its own. He engaged in zero communication with the outside world. He never snapped a photo. He did not keep a journal. His camp was undisclosed to everyone. There may have been others like Knight whose commitment to isolation was absolute. He planned to live his entire life in secret, but if so, they were never found. Capturing Knight was the human equivalent of netting a giant squid. He was an uncontacted tribe of one. Reporters across Maine, and soon enough across the nation and the world, attempted to contact him. What did he wish to tell us? What secrets had he uncovered? How had he survived? He stayed resolutely silent. After his arrest, the North Pond Hermit remained a complete mystery. I decided to write him a letter. I wrote it by hand, pen on paper, and sent it from my home in Montana to the Kennebec County Jail. I mentioned I was a journalist seeking explanations for his baffling life. A week later, a white envelope arrived in my mailbox. The return address, printed in blue ink in wobbly-looking block letters, read Chris Knight. It was a brief note, three paragraphs, 272 words. Still, it contained some of the first statements Knight had shared with anyone in the world. I replied to your letter, he explained, because writing letters relieves somewhat the stress and boredom of my present situation. Also, he didn't feel comfortable speaking. My verbal skills had become rather rusty and slow. I'd mentioned in my letter that I was an avid reader. From what I could tell, Knight was too. Many victims of Knight's thefts reported that their books were often stolen, from Tom Clancy Potboilers to dense military histories to James Joyce's Ulysses. Hemingway, I wrote, was one of my favorites. It seemed that Knight was shy about everything except literary criticism. He answered that he felt rather lukewarm about Hemingway. Instead, he noted he'd rather read Rudyard Kipling, preferably his lesser-known works. As if catching himself getting a little friendly, he added that since he didn't know me, he really didn't want to say more. Then he seemed concerned that he was now being too unfriendly. I wince at the rudeness of this reply, but I think it is better to be clear and honest rather than polite. Tempted to say nothing personal, but handwritten letters are always personal. He ended with, "It was kind of you to write, thank you." He did not sign his name. I wrote him back and sent him a couple of Kipling's The Man Who Would Be King and Captain's Courageous. His response, 2.5 pages, felt as raw and honest as a diary entry. He was suffering in jail. The noise and the filth tore at his senses. You asked how I sleep? Little and uneasy. I am nearly always tired and nervous. In his letter, he added, in his staccato, almost song lyric style, that he deserved to be in prison. I stole. I was a thief. I repeatedly stole over many years. I knew it was wrong, felt guilty about it every time, yet continued to do it. We exchanged letters throughout the summer of 2013. Rather than becoming gradually more accustomed to jail, to being around other people, Knight was deteriorating. In the woods, he said, he'd always carefully maintained his facial hair, but now he stopped shaving. "Use my beard," he wrote, "as a jail calendar." He tried several times to converse with other inmates. He could force out a few hesitant words, but every topic, music, movies, television, was lost on him, as was most slang. "You speak like a book," one inmate teased, whereupon he ceased talking. "I am retreating into silence as a defensive move," he wrote. Soon he was down to uttering just 5 words, and only to guards, "Yes, no, please, thank you." I am surprised by the amount of respect this garners me. That silence intimidates, puzzles me. Silence is, to me, normal, comfortable. He wrote about his time in the woods, but what he did reveal was harrowing. Some years he made it clear he barely survived the winter. In one letter, he told me that to get through difficult times, he tried meditating. "I didn't meditate every day, month, season in the woods, just when death was near. Death in the form of too little food or too much cold for too long. Meditation worked," he concluded. "I am alive and sane. At least I think I'm sane." As always, there was no formal closing. His letter simply ended, sometimes mid-thought. He returned to the theme of sanity in a following letter. "When I came out of the woods, they applied the label hermit to me. Strange idea to me. I had never thought of myself as a hermit. Then I got worried. With the label hermit comes the idea of crazy. See the ugly little joke." Even worse, he feared his time in jail would only prove correct to those who doubted his sanity. "I suspect," he wrote, "more damage has been done to my sanity in jail in months than years, decades in the woods." His legal proceedings were mired in delays as the district attorney and his lawyer tried to figure out how justice could be served in a case entirely without precedent. After 4 months in jail, Knight had no clue what punishment awaited. A sentence of a dozen or more years was possible. "Stress levels sky high," he wrote. "Give me a number. How long? Months? Years? How long in prison for me? Tell me the worst. How long?" In the end, he decided he couldn't not even write. "For a while, writing relieved stress for me. No longer." He sent one last heartbreaking letter in which he seemed the verge of a breakdown. "Still tired, more tired, tireder, tiredest, tired ad nauseum, tired infinitum." And that was it. He never wrote me again. Though he did finally sign his name, despite the exhaustion and the tension, the last words he penned were wry and self-mocking. "Your friendly neighborhood hermit, Christopher Knight." 3 weeks after his final letter, I flew to Maine. The Kennebec County Jail, a 3-story slab of pale gray cinder blocks, permits visitors most evenings at 6:45. I arrived early. "Who are you here to see?" asked a corrections officer. "Christopher Knight." "Relationship?" "Friend," I answered unconfidently. He did not know I was here, and I had my doubts he'd see me. I sat on a bench as other visitors checked in. Beyond the walls of the waiting room, I could hear piercing buzzers and slamming doors. Eventually, an officer appeared and called out, "Knight." He'd unlocked a maroon door, and I stepped inside a visitor's booth. 3 short stools were bolted to the floor in front of a narrow desk. Over the desk, dividing the booth into sealed-off halves, was a thick pane of shatterproof plastic. Sitting on a stool on the other side of the pane was Christopher Knight. Rarely in my lifetime have I witnessed someone less pleased to see me. His lips thin, were pulled into a downturned scowl. His eyes did not rise to meet mine. I sat across from him, and there was no acknowledgement of my presence. Not the merest nod. He gazed someplace beyond my left shoulder. He was wearing a dull green, over-laundered jail uniform, several sizes too big. A black phone receiver was hanging on the wall. I picked it up. He picked his up. I saw him make. I spoke first. "Nice to meet you, Chris." He didn't respond. He just sat there, stone-faced. His balding head shone like a snowfield beneath the fluorescent lights. fluorescent lights. His beard was a mess of reddish-brown curls. He had on silver-framed glasses, different from the ones he'd worn forever in the woods. He was very skinny. He'd lost a great deal of weight since his arrest. I tend to babble when I'm nervous, but I made a conscious effort to restrain myself. I recalled what Knight wrote in his letter about being comfortable with silence. I looked at him, not looking at me. Maybe a minute passed. That was all I could endure. The constant banging and buzzing in here, I said, must be so jarring compared with the sounds of nature. He shifted his eyes to me, a small victory, then glanced away. His eyes are light brown. He scarcely has any eyebrows. I let my comment hang in the air. Then he spoke, or at least his mouth moved. His first words to me were inaudible. I saw why. He was holding the phone's mouthpiece too low, below his chin. It had been decades since he'd used a phone. He was out of practice. I indicated with my hand that he needed to move it up. He did. And he repeated his grand pronouncement. "It's jail," he said. There was nothing more. Silence again. I shouldn't have come. He didn't want me here. I didn't feel comfortable being here. But the jail had granted me a one-hour visit, and I resolved to stay. I settled atop my stool. I felt hyper-aware of all my gestures, my expressions, my breathing. Chris's right leg, I saw through the scuffed window, was bouncing rapidly. He scratched at his skin. My patience was rewarded. First, his leg settled down. He quit scratching. And then, rather shockingly, he started talking. "Some people want me to be this warm and fuzzy person, all filled with friendly hermit wisdom, just spouting off fortune cookie lines from my hermit home." His voice was clear. He'd retained the stretch of vowels of a down east Maine accent, and his words, when he deigned to release them, could evidently be imaginative and entertaining and caustic. "Your hermit home like under a bridge," I said, trying to play along. He presented me with an achingly long blink. "You're thinking of a troll." I laughed. His face moved in the direction of a smile. We had made a connection, or at least the awkwardness of our introduction had softened. We began to converse somewhat normally. He called me Mike, and I called him Chris. He explained about the lack of eye contact. "I'm not used to seeing people's faces," he said. "There's too much information there. Aren't you aware of it? Too much, too fast." I followed his cue and looked over his shoulder while he stared over mine. We maintained this arrangement for most of the visit. Chris had recently been given a mental health evaluation by Maine's Forensic Service. The report mentioned a possible diagnosis of Asperger's disorder, a form of autism often marked by exceptional intelligence but extreme sensitivity to motions, sounds, and light. Chris had just learned of Asperger's while in jail. He seemed unfazed by the diagnosis. "I don't think I'll be a spokesman for the Asperger's telethon. Do they still do telethons? I hate Jerry Lewis." He said he was taking no medications. "But I don't like people touching me," he added. "You're not a hugger, are you?" I admitted that I do at times participate in embraces. "I'm glad this is between us," he said, indicating the glass. "If there was a set of blinds here, I'd close them." There was a part of me that was perversely charmed by Chris. He would seem prickly, he is prickly, but this was merely a protective cover. He told me that since his capture, he'd often found himself emotionally overwhelmed at unexpected moments. "Like TV commercials," he said, "have made me teary. It's not a good thing in jail to have people see you crying." Everything he said seemed candid and blunt, unfiltered by the safety net of social niceties. "I'm not sorry about being rude if it gets to the point quicker," he told me. "That's fine," I said, though I expected to ask questions that might kindle his rudeness, but I started with a gentle one. "What was your life like before you went into the forest?" Before he slept in the woods for a quarter century straight, Chris never once spent a night in a tent. He was raised in a community of Albion, a 45-minute drive east of his camp. He has four older brothers and one younger sister. His father, who died in 2001, worked in a creamery. His mother, now in her 80s, still lives in the same house where Chris grew up, a modest two-story colonial on a wooded 50-acre plot. The family is extremely private and did not speak with me. Their next-door neighbor told me that in 14 years, he hasn't exchanged more than a word with Chris's mom. Sometimes he sees her getting the paper. Culturally, my family is old Yankee, Chris said. We're not emotionally bleeding all over each other. We're not touchy-feely. Stoicism is expected. Chris insisted that he had a fine childhood. No complaints, he said. I had good parents. He shared vivid stories of moose hunting with his father. A couple of hunting trips, I slept in the back of a pickup, but never alone and never in a tent. After he disappeared, his family apparently didn't report him missing to the police, though they may have hired a private detective. No one uncovered a clue. Two of Chris's brothers, Joel and Tim, visited him in jail. I didn't recognize them, Chris admitted. My brother supposed I was dead, said Chris, but never expressed this to my mom. They always wanted to give her hope. Maybe he's in Texas, they'd say, or he's in the Rocky Mountains. Chris did not allow his mother to visit. Look at me. I'm in my prison clothes. That's not how I was raised. I couldn't face her. He said he had excellent grades in high school, though no friends, and graduated early. Like two of his brothers, he enrolled in a 9-month electronics course at Sylvania Technical School in Waltham, Massachusetts. He took a job installing home and vehicle alarm systems, valuable knowledge to have once he started stealing. He bought a new car, a white 1985 Subaru Brat. His brother, Joel, co-signed the loan. I screwed him on that, Chris said. I still owe him. He worked less than a year before he quit. He drove the brat to Maine, went through his hometown without stopping, one last look around, and kept driving north. Soon he reached the edge of Moosehead Lake, where Maine begins to get truly remote. I drove until I was nearly out of gas. I took a small road, then a small road off that small road, then a trail off that. He parked the car. He placed the keys in the center console. I had a backpack and minimal stuff. I had no plans. I had no map. I didn't know where I was going. I just walked away. It was late summer of 1986. He'd camp in one spot for a week or so, then hike south following the natural geology of Maine with its long glacier-carved valleys. I lost track of where I was, he said. I didn't care. For a while, he tried foraging for food. He ate roadkill partridges. Then he began taking corn and potatoes from people's gardens. But I wanted more than vegetables, he said. It took a while to overcome my scruples. I was always scared when stealing, always. He insists he never encountered anyone during a robbery. He made sure there was no car in the driveway, no sign of anyone inside. It was usually 1 or 2 a.m. I'd go in, hit the cabinets, the refrigerator, in and out. My heart rate was soaring. It was not a comfortable act. I took no pleasure in it, none at all, and I wanted it over as quickly as possible. A single mistake, he understood, and the outside world would snatch him back. All right, I'm going to take a quick break before I continue reading this story. Let's play some music for you. Let me think, what are we in the mood for? You know what? I was just talking to Philly Wonka earlier today. Let's do some Philly Wonka. Let me find him. Oh, my goodness. It's the one I have on here right now. Where is it? Doc Fibes featuring Philly Wonka with the song OMG. I'm going to do one or two songs and then we'll continue with the story. Thank you for listening.
OMG, please. I got a gun. like Janie, so don't tempt me. I'll shoot till it's empty. Smoke ring, drink dark and rock purple.
Yep.
Plus I'm weirder than a fucking crop circle. DOC spit TNT, I'll be on TMZ.
Right.
One day.
For what?
Jumping Lil Wayne. I'm just playing. Or am I? Looking damn fly. What I'm saying, to me this ain't a game.
What is it?
It's strange as cat's eyes. I got an awkward flow. This I know, but it's so 2024. By then your kids are grown, by then I'm gone. But you'll know my songs and know you did me wrong. And you could call your mains to get me killed. He'll hear my shit one time like, my God, this kid is ill. Get your fill. I'm popping bottles, music while you can, cause that I can't stand. They'll be damned. Walk the wall, I'm on your neighbor's rooftop, chilling like a rooster cock villain. Doc, my hip hop's illin'. I'm odd like in a Rory Borealis. Yeah, that Philly Wonka malice. They're Dallas from my brain to my Vena Digitalis.
Yep.
I check the underground artist article. They up and change your name to Artichoke. You claim to be a giant, you a particle. So to the people in this game, you are the joke. It's the Philly, the silly Philly, the Mr. Motherfucking Philly Wonka, y'all. You wanna see me?
Yeah.
You wanna be me?
I know.
I'm Jimmy John's fast urban heebie jeebie.
I'm so weird, you see. Ain't no MC that's nearly as near as me.
Nope.
I'm super duper. Yes, I'm Bombay.
Yeah.
You're uber goober. Come drop day.
From that maximum cage, underground rap is like minimum wage. December bars bring your mind from that maximum cage. This underground rap is like minimum wage.
Hey yo, I'm tired of my job, wanna spit on the stage. I'm trying to be a trillionaire, fuck the minimum wage. I'm shivering, bitter kid as I sit in the cage. Got a gun to my brain with the pen to the page. Went to jail once, fucking with the minimum wage. Been through hell, son, still ain't off the minimum wage. Where the nail gun, Snoop, please kill me today. While we impale them, brute, we the creme de la creme. Say what I said as I'm sending you rage. As a man in the ending, as the Benjamins raised. A brilliant civilian, shimmering new age. We resemble toupees, we are twins toupees. I know many Mary Janes, double L's, two J's. Ladies love cool cakes, blaze the blunt through ace. We will never give a pickup in this minimum wage. Fuck Miss Victory and a piss to the face.
My music's not a fad, yeah it's timeless. Yeah it's timeless. Yeah it's timeless. Said my music's not a fad. Yeah it's timeless. Yeah it's timeless. Yeah it's timeless. My bars free your mind from that maximum cage. Underground rap is like minimum wage. Instead of my bars, bring your mind from that maximum cage. This underground rap is like minimum wage.
Yo, that underground rap. Will it take me under? I tried to skip to the front, I had to take a number. It's hard seeing your dreams from the back of the line. Just know you got what it takes in the back of your mind. I'm getting antsy, I'm sick and tired of seeing MCs on fancy. How many bucks you need, negative Nancy? I just performed at the club, and now I can't say cause of these clothes that ain't love. It's hard making songs with people that don't know. And you better rock the stage if nobody show. I'm getting like my pop. Yeah, I need my medicine. The sky had a spirit shop. I hope daddy let it in. Too much on my tab. It's called a gift of gab. It's a gift and a curse. I flip the good from the bad. I'm trying to make it happen. Why you wish you had? You just call it rapping. My music's not a fad.
Said my music's not a fad. Yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless. Said my music's not a fad. Yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless. My bars free your mind from that maximum cage.
Underground rap is like minimum wage. Instead of bars, bring your mind from that maximum cage. This underground rap is like minimum wage.
Hey, yo, I'm spitting off a minimum wage. Rarely seeing Benjamin's face. Raised with a pen and a page. Trying to keep my Ziploc bag filled halfway with some really good shit. Keep me good all day. Hey, I am who I am. With a hand on my nuts. Yeah, that lazy motherfucker not giving a fuck. The crooked eye, wicked style, like it came from a book. The same guy that I was, still sparing the buck. The daily rapper spends his day trying to develop a story to make him seem better when he steps toe to toe with me, homie. No matter what you do, I'ma shatter you. Yo, skills over bills, that's my motherfucking attitude. And where I'm coming from, either you were holding some or you really played it dumb. Getting paid at the first of the month, the shit wasn't enough. Lil mama, move your hips like my payroll went up.
Said my music's not bad, yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless, yeah, it's timeless. Said my music's not bad, yeah, it's timeless. Yeah, it's timeless, yeah, it's timeless. My bars free your mind from that maximum cage. Underground rap is like minimum wage. Instead my bars bring your mind from that maximum cage. This underground rap is like minimum wage.
It's about time you discovered Nick Fastari. He's big on the dance scene in Europe and huge in Japan. Now Nick Fastari is making it big globally with his exciting new debut EP titled This Is Me Slower and Faster. From romantic ballads to edgier punk rock tinged hits, this new EP could be the soundtrack to your life. Get Nick Fastari's debut EP, This Is Me Slower and Faster, available on iTunes, Amazon, and download sites worldwide.
Captain's name was Ralph D. Bird. He gets stoned.
All right, everybody, welcome back. That was the Copas Brothers Band with the Towboat song. Before that, you heard Kyle Young, Ace Alexander, and Crown with Minimum Wage, and Philly Wonka, Doc Fives and Philly Wonka, OMG. And I'm going to go back to read you the second half of the story I have been talking about with you tonight. It's about a man named Chris Knight, and it was an article that I had found on GQ. Basically, they call him a hermit. He eventually was found and taken to jail because over like 25, 30 years, he was living in the woods by himself. But to live, he was stealing from people and had probably about 1,000-ish robberies in the area. So what I was just reading before the songs I played was talking about, you know, he did well in school. He was taught well in his family. He took a job, but then ended up just taking off in his new car one day and driving until he ran out of gas and kind of just went in the middle of nowhere. And I'll start a little like a paragraph or two back from where we started just so you can get back into it. But it says, I drove until I was nearly out of gas. I took a small road, then a small road off that small road, then a trail off that. He parked the car. He placed the keys in the center console. I had a backpack and minimal stuff. I had no plans. I had no map. I didn't know where I was going. I just walked away. Now, this man at the time was 20 years old. That's been quite a while ago. It was late summer of 1986. He'd camp in one spot for a week or so, then hike south following the natural geology of Maine with its long glacier-carved valleys. I lost track of where I was, he said. I didn't care. For a while, he tried foraging for food. He ate roadkill partridges. Then he began taking corn and potatoes from people's gardens. But I wanted more than vegetables, he said. It took a while to overcome my scruples. I was always scared when stealing. Always. He insists he never encountered anyone during a robbery. He made sure there was no car in the driveway, no sign of anyone inside. It was usually 1 or 2 a.m. I'd go in, hit the cabinets, the refrigerator, in and out. My heart rate was soaring. It was not a comfortable act. I took no pleasure in it, none at all. And I wanted it over as quickly as possible. A single mistake, he understood, and the outside world would snatch him back. He roamed for about 2 years before he discovered the campsite he would call home. He knew it at once. It was ideal. Then, he said, I settled in. The majority of North Pond residents I spoke with found it hard to believe Knight's story. Many insisted that he either had help or spent the winters in unoccupied cabins. As the time allotted for our visit wound down, I challenged Chris myself. You must, I said, have had assistance at some time, or slept in a cabin, or used a bathroom. Chris's demeanor changed. It was the only time in our meeting that he held eye contact. Never once did I sleep inside, he said. He never used a shower or a toilet. He did admit to thawing meat in a microwave a few times during break-ins, but he endured every season entirely on his own. I'm a thief. I induced fear. People have a right to be angry, but I have not lied. Did him. I sensed, in fact, that Chris was practically incapable of lying. I wasn't alone in this thought. Diane Perkins Vance, the state trooper present at his arrest, told me that much of her job consisted of sorting through lies people fed her. With Chris, however, she had no doubts. Unequivocally, she said, I believe him. Before he hung up the phone, Chris added that if I could see where he lived and how he survived, I'd know for sure. It was my plan to find his camp. Afterward, I said, I'd like to return to the jail. Could we meet again? His answer was unexpected. He said, yes. The Belgrade Lakes area where Knight lived is cow and horse rural, nothing like the vast north woods of Maine, wild and unpeopled. Knight's camp was located on private property just a few hundred feet from the nearest cabin in an area crisscrossed by dirt roads. When I saw Knight's woods myself, I understood how he could remain there unnoticed. The tangle of hemlock and maple and elm is so dense, the forest holds its own humidity. One step in and my glasses fogged. But what made navigation truly treacherous were the boulders, vehicle-sized glacier-borne gifts from the last ice age, scattered wildly and everywhere. I thrashed about for an hour, wrenched a knee between two moss-slick rocks, then gave up and retreated to a road. Before Chris was jailed, he'd led Hughes and Perkins Vance to his camp. I knew roughly where it was located, but my second attempt was also a failure. There was no hint of a trail. Mosquitoes swarmed. Finally, reduced to slogging in a grid-like pattern, I squeezed around a boulder, and there it was. My goodness, Chris had carved from the chaos a bedroom-sized clearing completely invisible from a few steps away. Situated on a slight rise that allowed enough breeze to keep the mosquitoes away, but not so much as to cause severe wind chill in winter. It was surrounded by a natural Stonehenge of boulders. Overhead, tree branches linked to form a trellis-like canopy that masked his sight from the air. This is why Chris's skin was so pale. He'd lived in perpetual shade. I ended up staying there 3 nights, watching the rabbits by day, and at night picking out a few stars behind the scrim of branches. It was as gorgeous and peaceful a place as I have ever spent time. The police had dismantled much of his camp, but during my next visit with Chris, and several after that, he described his living space in meticulous detail. In total, Chris and I met at the jail for 9 hours. He slept in a simple camping tent, which he kept covered by several layers of brown tarps. Camouflage, he felt, was essential. He didn't want to risk anything shiny catching someone's eye, so he spray-painted in foresty colors his garbage bins and his coolers and his cooking pot. He even painted his clothespins green. The breadth of his thievery was impressive. Fled the modern world, only to live off the fat of it. Inside his tent was a metal bed frame he'd removed from the Pinewoods tree camp. He had hauled it across the pond in a canoe. He didn't steal the canoe. He just borrowed one, as he often did, from a lakeside cabin. There's a wide selection. Then returned it, sprinkling pine needles inside to make it seem unused. He also stole the box spring and a mattress and sleeping bags. He stole toilet paper and hand sanitizer for his bathroom spot. He took laundry detergent and shampoo for his wash area. There was no fire pit, as he'd insisted. He cooked on a Coleman 2-burner stove that he connected to propane tanks. He stole a tremendous number of tanks, pillaging gas grills along the 30-mile circumference of the pond. He never returned them. He buried the tanks, possibly hundreds of them, in his dump at the camp's edge. He stole deodorant, disposable razors, flashlights, snow boots, spices, mousetraps, spray paint, and electrical tape. He took pillows off beds. He got 3 different types of thermometers in camp, digital, mercury, spring-loaded. Knowing the exact temperature was mandatory. He stole watches. He had to be sure, while on a raid, that he could return to camp before daybreak. Deeper into the forest, in his upper cache, as he called it, he'd stashed plastic totes filled with enough supplies, a tent and a sleeping bag, some warm clothes, so that if he heard someone approaching his camp, he could instantly abandon it and start anew. He was committed. His diet was terrible. Cooking is too kind a word for what I did, Chris told me. He'd not been sick in the woods, and his worst accident was a tumble on some ice, but his teeth were rotten, and no wonder. I dug through his 25 years of trash buried between boulders and kept an inventory, a 5-pound tub that once held marshmallow fluff, an empty box of Devil Dogs, peanut butter, Cheetos, honey, graham crackers, Cool Whip, tuna fish, coffee, tater tots, pudding, soda, El Monterey spicy jalapeno chimichangas, and on and on. He stole radios and earphones and hid an antenna up in trees. For a while, he listened to a lot of conservative talk radio. Later, he got hooked on classical music, Tchaikovsky and Brahms, Bach no. Bach is too pristine, he said. He went through a spell of listening to television shows on the radio, theater of the mind, he called it. Everybody Loves Raymond was a favorite, but his undying passion was classic rock, The Who, AC/DC, Judas Priest, and above all, Lynyrd Skynyrd. We covered hundreds of topics while chatting in jail, and nothing received higher praise than Lynyrd Skynyrd. They will be playing Lynyrd Skynyrd songs in 1,000 years, he proclaimed. He also stole the occasional handheld video game Pokemon, Tetris, Dig Dut, but the majority of his free time was spent reading or observing the forest. Don't mistake me for some bird-watching PBS type, he warned, but then proceeded to poetically describe the crunch of dry leaves underfoot, walking on cornflakes, and the rumble of an ice crack propagating across the pond like a bowling ball rolling down an alley. He stole hundreds of books over the years. His preference was military historian. He named William Schreyer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and his favorite book, but he took whatever was available, or as his favorite book, sorry, but he took whatever was available. Magazines were more common. When he finished them, he'd create bricks of magazines bound with electrical tape and bury them in the ground to level out his camp. Beneath his tent were dozens of these bricks. I unearthed a stack of National Geographics with the date still legible, 1991 and 1992. I also saw People, Cosmopolitan, Glamour, and Vanity Fair. There was even a collection of Playboys. One book Chris never stole was the Bible. I can't claim a belief system, he said. He celebrated no holidays. He meditated now and then, but did not pray. With one exception, when the worst of a Maine winter struck, all rules were suspended. Once you get below negative 20, you purposely don't think, he told me. His eyes went wide and fearful from the memory. That's when you do have religion. You do pray. You pray for warmth. Chris lived by the rhythms of the seasons, but his thoughts were dominated by surviving winter. Preparations began at the end of each summer, as the lakeside cabins were shutting down for the year. It was my busiest time, he said, harvest time, a very ancient instinct, though not usually associated with crime. His first goal was to get fat. This was a life or death necessity. I gorged myself on sugar and alcohol, he said. It's the quickest way to gain weight, and I like the inebriation. The bottles he stole were signs of a man who's never once, as he admitted, ordered a drink at a bar. Allen's coffee-flavored brandy, Seagram's Escape strawberry daiquiri, something called whipped chocolate valley vines, from the label fine chocolate whipped cream and red wine. As the evenings began to chill, he grew his beard to the ideal length of about an inch, long enough to insulate his face, short enough to prevent ice buildup. He intensified his thieving raids, stacking up on food and propane. The first snow usually came in November. Chris was always fearful about leaving a single boot print anywhere, which is impossible to avoid in a blanket of snow. And so for the next 6 months, until spring thaw in April, Chris rarely strayed from his clearing in the woods. I asked him if he slept all the time, a human hibernation. Completely wrong, he replied. It's dangerous to sleep too long in winter. When seriously frigid weather descended, he conditioned himself to fall asleep at 7:30 p.m. and get up at 2 a.m. Sorry, I'm starting to talk over myself. And so he fell asleep at 7:30 p.m. and got up at 2 a.m. That way, at the depth of cold, I was awake. If he remained in bed any longer, condensation from his body could freeze his sleeping bag. If you try to sleep through that kind of cold, you might never wake up. I asked him if he just slept, The first thing he'd do at 2 a.m. was light his stove and start melting snow. To get his blood circulating, he'd pace the perimeter of his camp. His feet never seemed to fully thaw, but as long as he had a fresh pair of socks, This wasn't a problem. It's more important to be dry than warm, Chris said. By dawn, he'd have his day's water supply. Then, if I had food, I'd have a meal. And if he didn't have food? There were, he said, some very hard winters, desperate winters, in which he ran out of propane and finished his food. The suffering was acute. Chris called it physical, emotional, and psychological pain. He hinted to me there were times he contemplated suicide. Why not just leave the woods? Chris said he thought about it. He even kept a whistle in his camp. If I blew on it in sequences of three, help might come. But he never used it. Rather, he made a firm decision that unless forcibly removed, he was going to spend the rest of his life behind the trees. When he heard the song of the chickadees, he told me, he could finally relax. That alerted me that winter is starting to lessen its grip, that the end is near, that spring is coming, and I am still alive. The cold never got easier. All his winter camping expertise felt offset by advancing age. You should have seen me in my 20s, he boasted. I was lord of the woods. I ruled the land, and I walked the land I walked upon. I was tough and clever, but over time, like an aging athlete, his body began to break down. The biggest issue was his eyesight. For the last 10 years, anything beyond an arm's length was a blur. I used my ears more than my eyes. If he saw a pair of glasses during a break-in, he always tried them on, but was unable to find a better prescription. His agility faded. Bruises took longer to heal. His teeth constantly hurt. The victims of his theft, after years of waiting for a police breakthrough, eventually took matters into their own hands. Neil Patterson, whose family owned a place on the pond for 50 years, began hiding all night in his dark house with a .357 Magnum in his hand. I wanted to be the guy that caught the hermit, he said. He stayed up 14 nights one summer before he quit. Debbie Baker, whose young boys were terrified of the hermit, to quell their fears, the family renamed him the Hungry Man, installed a surveillance camera in their cabin, and in 2002 they captured a photo of Knight. The police widely distributed the photo and figured an arrest was imminent. It took 11 more years. After a robbery in March of 2013 at the Pine Tree Camp, Sergeant Terry Hughes, who often volunteered there, contacted the Border Patrol for advice. It had gone on long enough, said Hughes. He installed a motion detector that sounded an alarm at his house and practiced dashing from his bed to the camp until he had it down under 4 minutes. Then Hughes waited for the hermit to return. Following his arrest, the court of public opinion was deeply divided. The man who wanted to live his life as invisibly as possible had become one of the most famous people in Maine. He could not walk into a bar in the Augusta area without stumbling into a debate about what should be done with Christopher Knight. Some said that he must immediately be released from jail. Stealing cheese and bacon are not serious crimes. The man was apparently never violent. He didn't carry a weapon. He's an introvert, not a criminal. He clearly has no desire to be part of our world. Let's open a Kickstarter. Get him enough cash for a few years' worth of groceries and allow him to get back into the woods. Some people were willing to let him live on their land rent-free. Others countered that it wasn't the physical items he robbed that made his crimes disturbing. He stole hundreds of people's peace of mind, their sense of security. How are they supposed to know Knight wasn't armed and dangerous? Even if a single break-in can be punishable by a 10-year sentence. If Knight really wanted to live in the woods, he should have done so on public lands, hunting and fishing for food. He's nothing but a lazy man and a thief. Times 1,000. Lock him up in the state penitentiary. On October 28, 2013, Chris appeared in Kennedick County Superior Court and pleaded guilty to 13 counts of burglary and theft. He was sentenced to 7 months in jail. He'd already served all but a week of this, waiting for his case to be resolved. The sentence was far more lenient than it could have been, though even the prosecutor said a long prison term seemed cruel in this case. Chris was ordered to meet with a judge every Monday and avoid alcohol and either find a job or go to school. If he violated those terms, he could be sent to prison for 7 years. Before his release, I met with Chris again. He said he'd be returning home to live with his mother. His beard was unruly, my crazy hermit beard, he called it. He was alarmingly skinny. He itched all over. We still didn't make much eye contact. I don't know your world, he said, only my world, and memories of this world before I went into the woods. What life is today? What is proper? I have to figure out how to live. He wished he could return to his camp. I miss the woods. But he knew by the rules of his release that this was impossible. Sitting here in jail, I don't like what I see in the society I'm about to enter. I don't think I'm going to fit in. It's too loud, too colorful. The lack of aesthetics, the crudeness, the initiates, the trivia. I don't think that's initiates. Inanities? I don't even know that word. The trivia. I told him I agreed with much of his assessment, but I wondered, what about your world? What insights did you glean from your time alone? I had been trying to ask him these questions every visit, but now I pushed the point harder. Anyone who reveals what he's learned, Chris told me, is not, by his definition, a true hermit. Chris had come around on the idea of himself as a hermit and eventually embraced it. When I mentioned Thoreau, who spent 2 years at Walden, Chris dismissed him with a single world. Dilettante. There's another word I don't know. I'm going to have to get a dictionary or something. True hermits, according to Chris, do not write books, do not have friends, and do not answer questions. I asked why he didn't at least keep a journal in the woods. Chris scoffed. I expected to die out there. Who would read my journal? You? I'd rather take it to my grave. The only reason he was talking to me now, he said, is because he was locked in jail and needed to practice interacting with others. But you must have thought about things, I said, about your life, about the human condition. Chris became surprisingly introspective. I did examine myself, he said. Solitude did increase my perception, but there's a tricky thing. When I applied my increased perception to myself, I lost my identity. With no audience, no one to perform for, I was just there. There was no need to define myself. I became irrelevant. The moon was the minute hand, the seasons the hour hand. I didn't even have a name. I never felt lonely. To put it romantically, I was completely free. That was nice, but still, I pressed on. There must have been some grand insight revealed to him in the wild. He returned to silence. Whether he was thinking or fuming or both, I couldn't tell. Though he did arrive at an answer, I felt like some great mystic was about to reveal the meaning of life. Get enough sleep. He set his jaw in a way that conveyed he wouldn't be saying more. This is what he'd learned. I'd accepted as truth. What I miss most, he eventually continued, is somewhere between quiet and solitude. What I miss most is stillness. He said he'd watched for years as a shelf mushroom grew on the trunk of a Douglas fir in his camp. I noticed the mushroom when I'd visited. It was enormous, and he asked me with evident concern if anyone had knocked it down. I assured him it was still there. In the height of the summer, he said, he'd sometimes sneak down to the lake at night. I'd stretch out in the water, float on my back, and look at the stars. And the very end of each of our visits, I'd always asked him the same question, an essential question. Why did he disappear? He never had a satisfying answer. I don't have a reason. I can't explain why. Give me more time to think about it. It's a mystery to me, too. Then he became annoyed. Why? That question bores me. But during our final visit, he was more reflective. Isn't everybody, he said, seeking the same thing in life? Aren't we all looking for contentment? He was never happy in his youth, not in high school, not with a job, not being around other people. Then he discovered his camp in the woods. I found a place where I was content, he said, his own perfect spot, the only place in the world he felt at peace. That was all he had to tell me. He'd grown weary of my visits. Please, he begged, leave me alone. We are not friends. I do not want to be your friend, he said. I don't want to be anyone's friend. I'm not going to miss you at all, he added. I liked Chris a great deal. I liked the way his mind worked. I liked the lyricism of his language. But he was a true hermit. He could no longer disappear into the wild, so he wished to melt away into the world. Goodbye, Chris, I said. A guard had appeared to escort him away. But there was a time for Chris to express a last thought. He did not. He hung up the phone. No wave, no nod. He stood, turned his back on me, and walked out of the visitor's booth and down a corridor of the jail. Oh, what a story. Oh, my goodness. So that was an article that I had found on GQ.com by Michael Finkel. And, wow, I just got goosebumps at the end of that because I had read most of it. But I just finished it live with you guys. What do you think? Fascinating. Wow. So please get back with me and give me your thoughts on that story. That was called The Strange and Curious Tale of the Last True Hermit by Michael Finkel on GQ.com. All right, I'm going to play one or two more songs, and then I'm going to call it a night because I have to work in the morning. Let's do Tori Lynn and Omi with the song Let Go.
Tori Lynn, L.O.C. Turn it back.